Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about prescribed burns to start the show today, and we have a couple of guests for you. Michelle Witeka, one of them. She is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Michelle, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
With us as well, a guy who's been with us a lot of times over the years for a lot of different topics, Jeb Barzin. He is also, among all the other things that he does, he's chair of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. And Jeb, good to see your smiling face.
Well, it is wonderful to be here, and thank you.
So, as we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Have you seen a prescribed burn? Wondered how it's kept confined and under control? What do you know about the benefits of them? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, there's a big difference between a wildfire and a prescribed burn, Michelle. How do prescribed burns help our state's ecosystem?
Sure, absolutely. There's a huge difference, and I guess I'll start with that. So when you think of a wildfire, you think of especially the wildfires that we had up in Canada in the last summer that impacted our air quality. So wildfires like that, when they move through a forest, they don't just burn what's on the ground. They move through the crowns of the trees. They are so hot that they burn the organic matter of the soil and scorch it. Every single lick of vegetation from bottom to top is completely removed.
Gone.
Yes. And so with these, you lose a lot of the old growth structure, you lose a lot of those different age classes of trees. Everything is reset to ground zero. And so, you know, you can imagine how long it takes to for that kind of system to come back. So when you think about a prescribed fire moving through something, say, like a forest, you're talking about flame lengths that are roughly the height of a fire hydrant. What they're doing is they're moving along the forest floor, and they're slowly consuming all of the dead fuel that's there and not really impacting the canopy or anything like that. Prescribed fires are really good for removing that mid-story that blocks light from hitting the forest floor and removing that dead thatch, what we call thatch, dead grasses and leaves, removes that layer, and that means better seed germination. It means those seedlings are better able to compete. And so rather than this whole-scale destruction of an entire vegetation structure and system, you have something that is more so revitalized. It's given a chance for trees to regenerate and grow without that competition, and it's a chance to benefit the local native species that have adapted with fire over time.
Yeah, because as I understand it, if you're you have a better chance to get rid of undesirable plants if you do that.
Absolutely, yes. So the plants that are moving into these, especially the forest systems, but also out in our prairies, you know, these woody species, they change the vertical structure of our prairies. They push out birds that are grassland birds that are intolerant of that higher brush and tree structure. They can do a pretty detrimental job in changing the structures of these fire-dependent ecosystems. And for species that aren't used to occasional prescribed fire will keep them out of these systems if that fire is done at the right time using, you know, the right methods.
So how does it affect animals, or how does it benefit animals, a prescribed burn?
Sure. So I'm going to go way back to, you know, what we know about Wisconsin fire history. And so unlike in other states where you see lightning as one of the natural causes of a fire, you know, especially down in the Southeast, for us up here, our history of fire is primarily driven by Native communities that have lived here for
a long time.
Exactly. And one of the things that these cultures used is fire, not only to manage the land around them, but also to provide food for the entire group and also to lure certain game animals nearby because of those game animals' positive response to fire. And so, you know, whether it was a lightning strike or it was by human hand, you know, these animals, these systems, they have evolved with periodic fire. They know where to go. They have an innate sense of what is coming just when they smell smoke. And they know they either need to hunker down or they need to move or they need to fly. And what we've seen, both Jeb and I, as prescribed fire practitioners, is we've seen plenty of animals of all species return to a burned site, recently burned, and they are utilizing what is left there, whether it's woodpeckers eating dead insects that have, you know, fallen, or it's deer munching on the ash because it provides them basic nutrients and minerals. There isn't a time throughout that prescribed burning cycle where animals haven't gotten used to utilizing that piece of land.
Hmm. Jim, I want to go to you because I don't know that much about the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. And here you are heading it up. Tell us more about the council's mission and what it does.
Well, we're a group of people who are interested in prescribed fire, as the name would imply, and that can range any anywhere from professionals who are practitioners of implementing prescribed fire, all the way through to private landowners who are interested in just being good stewards of their land and utilizing prescribed fire, learning more about prescribed fire so that they can use it on their own properties. And we're kind of everywhere in between.
Yeah.
But our bottom line is to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively.
So how do you help with prescribed fires?
Pretty much any way that we can figure out a way to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively. So we do training. We have we do outreach. We try to work with people to, if they're interested in prescribed fire, to figure out how to guide them towards resources to get that job done. And it can be through hiring a contractor. It could be through doing it on your own. It could be learning more about it so that you can do it safely on your own. But it also can be we're working with collaborators. And one of the reasons why Michelle and I wanted to come here together is that partnership is a really important part of trying to get more fire on the ground. There's
Absolutely.
Lots of different organizations that have a role in making that happen. And so as just one example, the council and the Department of Natural Resources are working together to create a certification program for fire leaders, what we call fire bosses, so that they can, that we have a more direct training to help people prepare on how to lead prescribed fires throughout most of the places in Wisconsin, from the pineries all the way through the prairies, basically P2P, so that they can do an effective job, you know, on a professional basis. That's at one end of the extreme, but we're also reaching out to private landowners who have a completely different set of needs to try and engage them to do prescribed fire on their lands. Because in the end, in Wisconsin, roughly 85% of land is still privately owned. And
yeah.
So if we need to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively, we need to work with private landowners to see, to figure out ways that that can happen.
And I imagine of that 85%, you know, the people who are landowners may have, may need some education, and I imagine there's always fear. I mean, well, right, for example, right now, today, you would not be doing a fire anywhere in the state because the DNR has prescribed the fire risk as too great. I think at least I got an email on that yesterday that said yesterday and the day were that way.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that I'm going to take this opportunity to expand on the high and the very high. You know, truth be told, when fire danger is high, what we mean that to say is that if fire is put on the ground, it stands a very big chance of spreading. The conditions are so that it is very favorable to spreading. And so, therefore, without the proper tools and equipment for suppression, water, you will not be able to stop that fire, and it will turn into a wildfire. So, you know, on very high days, we don't tend to burn. But on high days, you know, you will see people out there still prescribed burning. And that's because prescribed burning just isn't about going out, you know, licking your thumb, putting it in the air and, you know, and just starting. Prescribed fire takes some time to plan. You never want to go out there without a plan of, you know, what to do if things go wrong. But, yeah, if you're going out there and you don't have a lot of equipment, I would say pay attention very closely to high and very high. We do still have burns going when it's high, especially in the southeast right now, where we still have quite a bit of moisture in the marshes and the prairies. But, yeah, we have had to shut down burns lately because it has gotten a bit dry.
It's been dry in some parts of the state for sure.
Absolutely.
Don in Bayfield County has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hey. I live when they do burns in Bayfield County at the Barrens, boy, the blueberries really take off.
Don, I'm so glad you brought that up. That is a blueberry crop was actually one of the main crops that a lot of these indigenous communities would harvest and maintain with fire. And, you know, just on a side note, the blueberries post-burn, they are much sweeter. And actually, any nectar from wildflowers out there, not that you have a chance to sample, but bees will actually prefer recently burned wildflowers because the pollen is sweeter. So everything's sweeter after a prescribed burn. I got to market it.
Don, thank you so much. I love that comment. What about you? You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jeb Barzin, chair of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, one of our guests. The other, Michelle Wateka, who is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk prescribed burns with our guest today. By the way, Clara Neipert's our producer for this program, Trina LaSousa, our technical director, so I wanted to mention them as well. And our guest, Jeb Barzin of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, and Michelle Wateka, who is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, and you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Jean and Merrill next. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about bog geography. We live on a very small 150-acre lake in Lincoln County, and it really is perched right on the Ice Age Trail. So our own personal property, this is about property holders and their relationship to controlled burns, is goes from the lake shore to pine and balsa mix. And then very quickly, these tiny little bog areas. And I'm just wondering what.
Oh, we lost Jean. Maybe she got out of our area here. So she's probably wondering, and we'll turn to you, Jeb, for this. She's probably wondering about prescribed burns under those kind of circumstances. Could you do it in an area like that where you've got a small bog or a series of small bogs, but they kind of abut these pine trees and so forth?
Yes, it is possible to do. We're still learning a lot about prescribed fire and how communities, plant communities, animal communities are adapted to prescribed fire. And so understanding that bogs actually are fire-adapted communities is kind of a new thing because you think about it, it's, you know, bogs are typified by highly organic soils or organic matter that's been built up. And so the trick with burning in bogs is you want the water table high enough so that you don't burn deeply into that organic material, but shallow enough that the surface can burn, because many of the species, just like Don had talked about with blueberries, many of the species that are in the bog are stimulated by that fire, as long as that fire doesn't remove most of that vegetative mat. So the first part is, yes, some bogs are fire adapted, and they do benefit from being burned, and so it keeps them more of an open bog rather than a closed tamarack bog or black spruce bog. Sure. It kind of opens that up a bit. Mm-hmm. And but it also, I think this answer kind of gives people an idea of, oh, that's a little bit more complicated than I had thought.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to just go and say, oh, as Michelle was saying earlier, you don't want to lick your finger and hold it up for the wind and say, I think we'll burn the bog today.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit more effort to make sure that you get it right. Because if you get it wrong, it's real problematic. And the fire will go down deep into the bog. In the 1930s, there are some bogs that burned over winter because they could hold fire for a long time when the water table had dropped substantially. So something to be really important. But the other thing that Gene was talking about is that when you have pines that are next to it and your conditions of what is good weather for prescribed burning in pines and what is good weather for prescribed burning in bogs can be very different. And so there are times where you might want to separate them. There are other times where you could combine them together. But that's the interesting thing about prescribed fire. And I actually like the word prescribed as opposed to controlled.
Absolutely.
Because controlled just implies that you are controlling the fire that you're working with. But prescribed means that you're choosing your weather, you're choosing your place that you want to burn, you're choosing the crew who you're working with, you're choosing all sorts of scenarios to fit the particular needs to accomplish what you need to accomplish in that area. And so it's a much more complicated array of circumstances that you're really trying to develop in order to burn that safely as well as effectively part.
Sure.
That makes a lot of sense. And it does remind me that there, as you were talking, there's a lot of information out there, Michelle, for landowners and so forth, not only for a bog, but for any kind of prescribed fire.
Yeah, absolutely. So the council and the DNR work together to provide as many resources as we can for landowners who are interested in burning, whether that they want to burn it themselves and are looking at where to start, or if they're feeling like maybe for the first time or all the times they'd feel more comfortable with a professional. And so I'll leave it to Jeb as far as what the council can provide. But one more thing I did want to add, apparently because bog burning is so interesting, there's been recent studies that have come out that have actually shown not only the value of bogs in sequestering carbon, but also that these very, very rare burns that used to happen to them historically actually invigorates and increases their ability to sequester further carbon. So it is something to think about when we think about our carbon stores and who's doing the work and how we can potentially improve on that. But yes, of course, always the lower soil moistures are important, and we don't want to have a peat fire that pops up somewhere else.
Dave and Toma has a question. Dave, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I'm interested in seeing if there are groups that will come in and do a prescribed burn for people who don't have the resources or the know-how to do it themselves.
Jeb, go ahead.
There are groups that are out there. There are a number of different contractors located in, and they have areas that they focus on in the state. So there's very few contractors who will burn anywhere in the state.
Sure.
But lots of contractors who will burn in specific regions. And you can go to our website, which is prescribedfire.org. Should be an easy website to remember. And on that, we list contractors who are involved with prescribed burning. So that would be a first place where you can go to see different contractors. There are a few nonprofit organizations that sometimes will do prescribed fires on private lands, especially if they're adjacent to their own lands that the the organization might have. So you can also check that out.
I'm wondering if there are people here in the state who actually work on maybe even almost on a professional basis to fight fires, if they are also maybe part of these prescribed burn crews.
Yeah, you know, the best example of that is at the UW-Stevens Point. They have the kind of the longest running fire program, and it used to be primarily people who are getting trained in fire suppression, so that's putting out wildfires.
Yeah.
But now they're pretty equally distributed between those who are getting trained in fire suppression versus those who are getting trained in fire prescription, and there's lots of overlap between those two.
Of course. Yeah.
But there's really important differences in terms of how we approach training, and that's something that we're just really trying to develop now, and in part with a certification program, is trying to work on understanding how there's a really a different philosophy that is occurring with thinking about things from a suppression point of view versus thinking about things from a prescription point of view.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, 2/3 of our staff that work in the prescribed burn program are actually the same staff that are staffing at ranger stations and going out and suppressing wildfires. I can tell you that there's definitely different cultures. They tend to complement each other. But at times, yes, you see the difference in them. And I think the most important message that I can send is there are many different ways to walk into prescribed fire. You can come at it from a very organic place. You can come at it from a regimented suppression standpoint. But the fact of the matter is that we benefit from each other and we're getting the job done. But yeah, it is very interesting in the prescribed burn community. It's these different voices and perspectives are one of the things that make it great.
Mike and Mercer, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Is the Wisconsin DNR allowing wildlife biologists to do prescribed burns? I think they used to.
Absolutely. It depends on the level of the workload in that area of the state. So not necessarily every wildlife biologist is involved. But if they're in an area where there's real high prescribed fire needs, especially on the properties that they work, then they're most likely involved in the program.
Interesting. All right, Mike, thank you so much for calling. Sue from Amory emailed us. She has a follow-up question about the blueberries responding with sweeter berries after a fire. She has a small patch close to her garage, so she doesn't feel she can safely burn, but would bringing in wood ash have the same effect?
I'm going to... Jeb, you want to take that one? I think that's so cool.
It will approximate some of the things that are done. There's lots of different ways that we can approach management. And often what we're doing is we're trying to get close to prescribed fire but not use it. So you could browse it, encourage if you had horses, for example, have horses come in and browse it. That would get some of the things that prescribed fire does, but not all. And the ashes, for example, are... recreate some of the things that you would have with prescribed fire, but not everything, because prescribed fire isn't just creating ash that then the plants take up the minerals that are in that ash. The prescribed fire stimulates bacteria that are in the soil, which become more productive, that then allow the minerals to be taken up, that the plants then produce more foliar growth and flowering, as Michelle was talking about, and that sweeter flavor. So it's really creating a whole system effect, whereas the ashes are just one part of that system.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And so that's the cool thing about prescribed fire. There's really no replacement for prescribed fire writ large.
Sure.
But you can try to approximate it.
Yeah. There are other things like haying, mowing, brush cutting that can help change that vertical structure and reduce competition and get further, you know, sunlight onto the ground. But I mean, and we're not just saying this because we're biased, but
I'm biased. I don't know about you.
I remain silent. There are prescribed fire provides benefits that really no other technique mimics perfectly.
Yeah. So Sue and Amory, I don't know if you want to burn that right next to the garage, standing there with a fire with a hose looking. And I'm not sure at a really small patch. Would it really make a difference in a very small area?
Well, I think you can talk out of both. I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth
because
I'm kind of good at that. You can do that.
Uh-huh.
But this is fire prescription. So that means you have to choose your time, choose your day, choose your conditions, choose the what we call fire breaks that you have, the places where you can light fire from safely. So there's a lot to it, but it is possible. And one of the things that we need to do from the Prescribed Fire Council is figure out how to reach out with private landowners just in this sort of circumstance to say, you know, it's not as difficult to teach Sue and Amory how to burn her blueberry patch near her house as it is to teach a new professional prescribed burner who's going to try and burn any ecosystem in the southern part of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, there's just really different difficulties that are in that. And so we're working at trying to do a better job reaching out to people like Sue or other private landowners who want to get some fire done on their grounds and figure out ways to enable them to accomplish that. And the variety that's involved in accomplishing that is as diverse as there are people out there who have the need. And so that's what we're trying to do.
So Sue might even get a hold of, go online to the prescribed, what's the address again?
Prescribedfire.org.
Prescribedfire.org.
Yes. There,
Sue, there you go. You might be able to do it yet. appreciate your call. Karen in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi. You know, when I was young, we used to live way up in northern Wisconsin in Nicolet National Forest. My dad used to do burns all the time.
Wow. Nice.
So I'm familiar with this, but now I live down in west Wisconsin in Eau Claire, and people don't burn like that around here. But I have a horse pasture, and I always wanted to burn it off to get, you know, better grass growing and get nutrients and stuff in there. Does that help for a horse pasture?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and not just because it would reinvigorate those grasses, but also there's studies that have come out of the Smoky Hills area of the in Kansas. Sorry, the Flint Hills, not the Smoky Hills, and they've actually looked at the effects of fire on grass protein content. And other things, you know, when you're looking into a cattle range. And they've actually found that not only with everything will everything come back, yes, taste is a factor and it will benefit, but also grass typically contains about 30% more protein after it's been recently burned. So, yeah, if this is a place that you have, you know, your horses utilize, this is definitely something that, I mean, if I was in your case, this would be something that I would be regularly doing every several years just to make sure that those grasses stay revitalized and they can keep growing.
There you go, Karen. You have heard it here first. You're going to have a better pasture.
There are two things that you want to keep in mind, Karen, and that is, one, it depends on how you're managing your pasture currently. If you graze it really tight, that means that there's not much vegetation that's available, so it's a lot harder to burn that area because you keep it grazed down so much. So you need to kind of reduce, at least in some of the areas, the amount of grazing to leave a little bit of dead vegetation so that that will burn. And the other, it depends on what's there. So if it's an old pasture that's was at one time agriculture or something like that, so it's typically going to have what we call grasses that grow when the soil temperature is cool. that often are exotic. You burn that at a different time of year than if you have a prairie remnant that's been grazed. And those grasses, you have to kind of burn at a slightly different time of year. So kind of what's there in terms of the species of grass, as well as how much vegetation you've removed, are both important things to determine how you're going to approach doing that.
And I think one more thing I would add is, you know, just like Jeb says, you are going to have to rest the field beforehand to make sure that you have enough vegetation that will carry the fire through the pasture. But also, you know, when you just have black there, you still have all the grass's root structure underground. But you may want to pause and let that area recover before you start introducing hoof action and further disturbance, because that might definitely introduce more invasives and break up the root structure that you do have. So it's just really about allowing that disturbance to happen and then giving that time to rest after the disturbance. But it's something that is very beneficial. And if you reached out later, we'd be happy to provide you some more resources on how to get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling, Karen. Appreciate it. Kent in Reedstown called. He couldn't stay with us, but he's wondering if there's a bad time to bird during the year for insects. He wants to avoid burning the insects that make their home in the grass. And I know there are a couple times of the year when we normally burn. It's usually in the spring or in the fall. Jeb?
There's virtually no time that you can burn that won't be bad for some of the insects that are there. And that's both the good news and the bad news. There is a diverse array of insects that are using these areas, and so it's very difficult to not affect them. But the way insects often are adapted to fire is even though they might have a high mortality because of the fire, as long as there are places where the insects can recolonize from, they'll come back to that area and build their population numbers very quickly. As you know, we all know that insects are really capable of building their numbers rapidly. And the real trick is for insects that are what we call obligate to, say, prairies. You know, they only can occur in prairies. You don't want to burn all your eggs in one basket. So that you want to leave places within that prairie that don't burn when you're burning the other areas around it, so that you're guaranteeing that you have some of those insects that are not affected by the fire that can then recolonize the area that's where the vegetation is being stimulated by the fire and be more productive for those insects on a long-term basis.
And that unburned refugia is something that we actually plan for on sites where some of these insects are known to be, especially if they're listed. And that way they do have that unburned patch to colonize from and subsist there.
Trista sent us an interesting email. She's curious why there's not much objection to prescribed burning from people who are worried about air pollution.
Well, it's not to say that there isn't. We do occasionally get the comment about that, and it's totally understandable. Ever since last summer when air quality turned to everyone's attention. So the one thing that we do say in regards to air quality is, you know, when we do plan for a burn, we look at the neighborhoods, we look at the structures, the schools, airports, hospitals. Anything that if we sent smoke that way, we would negatively impact folks. And those are the areas that we choose not to burn in that direction. We try everything that we can in our plan to make sure our smoke is managed and goes off in a way that does not impact anyone. There's other factors that we take into account. We only burn on days where the smoke dispersal is going to lift and transport that wind away. And, you know, when we do have a burn and we do tend to have, you know, occasional smoke go across a road, we will contact local law enforcement to assist us with that. I mean, the point of this is to work and manage the land with prescribed fire with as little negative impact to the population as possible. But it is understandable with what happened in Canada last year. It was on everybody's minds.
Yeah, everywhere here in Wisconsin and a lot of other states as well. That fire burned a long, long time.
Yeah, and I want to go back to, you know, when we first started talking about the difference between wildfires and prescribed burns. You know, prescribed burns typically release about less than 1% of the emissions that wildfires like these will release. So the smoke is not as typically thick because whole, you know, trees aren't being burned up in the process. And so there is a difference between wildfire smoke and prescribed fire smoke. And prescribed fire smoke is something that we can do a lot of planning for.
And have you done some this year?
Absolutely.
Tell us what, give us a couple of examples.
Sure. So we have done a burn up at Crex Meadows so far, up in Burnett County. We have been doing quite a lot of burns along the lower Wisconsin Riverway, including 2,700 acre burn of Avoca Prairie, so right near the town of Avoca. We also have been doing a lot of really great work out in the Kettle Moraine State Forest over in the Waukesha area. And then, you know, there's so many properties around the state that people go to enjoy those beautiful vistas and those beautiful habitats. And we're working all through there. If folks are interested, they can have a look and see where we have been conducting burns so far this year. They can also see where burns are planned. And they can go back into past years with historic burns. And if I can either write out the website or if you Google Wisconsin Fire Dashboard, you will have our dashboards pulled up immediately. We've got one for wildfires and we've got one for prescribed burns. And that'll actually show you where we've conducted work so far. So we're at about 10,000 acres so far for the year. We did start a little early and we'll have to see whether or not the dryness shuts us down, but we hope to just keep trucking.
How many acres might you do in a year? What's the average number?
You know, in years past, in the last 10 years, we were probably averaging around 25,000 acres. But in the last 5 years, we've been able to do anywhere between 25 and 30,000 acres a year, and that's statewide.
Well, and that's just with the Department of Natural Resources.
Correct.
I think you're answering that question from. Yes. And the total amount of acreage is we're trying to be, we're up around, is it 75,000 acres?
Yes. So for what we know in terms of special permits in the DNR protection area, we know of federal burns, and we know of our burns. We're running roughly about 70,000 acres. But there's still a lot of spots in the state that we don't have information on, specifically in the cooperative areas of the state where the DNR does not have jurisdiction. Those burns are not tracked. So that is one of our endeavors moving forward, is to reach out to those practitioners and have them join with us in our you know, momentum moving forward.
Amphibians, are amphibians ever hurt in fires, or are they helped, or what, Jeb?
Fire can harm animals or plants when done improperly. And there's, you know, no, any time that you do any management practice, including doing nothing, you will have some species that increase, some species that decrease, and other species that are neutral. So kind of with that frame of reference, yes, fires can harm amphibians or reptiles, but we try to, because this is prescription, we try to do it in such a way that we minimize the damage and maximize the benefit is essentially, you know, what the goal is. And it's especially trying to focus on those species that are more adapted to that environment, especially when it's functioning on a healthy basis. So not all species can go in all places. And but, you know, if you have a ornate box turtle in the sand prairies in the lower Wisconsin River, we want to be able to burn before the ornate box turtles emerge from hibernation, because that reduces the chance of mortality to zero. So that's just one thing that we do in terms of how we go about doing a prescribed burn and minimizing the risk while still trying to maximize the benefit.
Well, that brings us to, you know, it's kind of a little segue into our next show, which is where we'll be talking about amphibians and reptiles a bit. But I want to thank you so much, Jeb and Michelle, for being with us today. It's been fun. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well. Thank you.
So glad to hear. Always happy to talk about prescribed fire.
You're welcome, and thanks for having us.
Jeb Barzin chairs the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. I want to say that right. And Michelle Wateka is the Prescribed Fire Specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have both of them with us. And we are going to be talking about amphibians, and we'll be taking a look at how pollution affects our amphibians, among other things, with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR.